And welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast. My name is Father Gregory Pine, and it's a joy to share with you another one of these off-campus conversations where I follow up with a speaker who will have lectured on campus or in the context of a retreat or a conference, just to chase down some insights and just deepen the conversation on themes that fall within the Catholic intellectual tradition. So for this installment, I'm very delighted to be joined by Dr. William Carroll. Thanks so much for joining.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
So folks might know you or may have heard from you. You've given several lectures for the Thomistic Institute, both for the science conference, the kind of Thomistic Natural Philosophy and Modern Science Conference, and then also on campuses. You're now doing a series of seminars for the students at Yale. But for those who haven't encountered you, would you just say a word of introduction, who you are and where you're from and what you do?
Okay. I am recently retired from teaching and research at Oxford University at the through the Aquinas Institute at Blackfriars, the Dominican College of Oxford. At Oxford, I was also a member of the Faculty of Theology, well, now it's called Religion and Theology, in a special section on religion and science, teaching undergraduate courses and graduate seminars on questions concerning the relationship between religion and science. Prior to going to Oxford, I taught for almost 30 years at a liberal arts college in Iowa, Cornell College. My training, academic background, is in intellectual history and the history of science, and my special interests in those areas are the reception of Aristotelian science in medieval Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, and the development of the doctrine of creation in the context of that reception of Aristotle. Not only Aristotle, but to some degree Plato, but primarily Aristotle. And then, based on my work in the Middle Ages, I looked at the ways in which the medieval discussion about creation and the natural sciences can be usefully appropriated today to examine a lot of the, or to diffuse some of the confusion in discussions about the implications of cosmology, evolutionary biology, and the neurosciences, the ways in which developments in these disciplines today have been used either to affirm or more often to deny the doctrine of creation. Also, I've done a lot of work on the encounter between Galileo and the Inquisition, and there's a kind of common theme here, a more overarching theme, the relationship between faith and reason with respect to the natural sciences and creation, and faith and reason in a particular historical event, the encounter between Galileo and the Inquisition. And in a way, there's another connection. That encounter between Galileo and the Inquisition is a very important chapter in the history of the relationship between science and religion, evidence, so it seems, for the incompatibility between science and religion, an incompatibility which many people see in contemporary discussions about the development between the natural sciences and the doctrine of creation. So there's a way of sort of connecting these various interests. And a further sort of biographical note, since I talk about the subjects of creation and science, and especially the role of Thomas Aquinas in helping to understand these discussions, I talk about this theme in many places throughout the world, especially in Argentina, Chile, and in Europe. But most interestingly, starting in 2013, in China. And I've been to China 9 times since 2013, talking about Thomas Aquinas' creation and contemporary science. And perhaps as we talk more about a proper understanding of creation, I can comment on the ways in which my Chinese audiences at various Chinese universities have come to appreciate Thomas Aquinas's understanding of creation as it relates to contemporary science, and perhaps also to comment on the enthusiasm in Chinese intellectual circles for the thought of Thomas Aquinas.
Well, then let's start with kind of methodological points, or let's start with just introductory points as to how is it that this putative or perceived conflict between faith and science, and specifically in the matter of the doctrine of creation, between creation and evolution, has gotten such a hold on the popular audience or on the popular narrative? Are there historical reasons for which, or are there doctrinal reasons for which? How do you set that stage, or how do you begin to explain to people how this came about?
Well, there are certainly, there are both historical reasons and there are some thematic questions about understanding what the natural sciences tell us and what the doctrine of creation is all about. But since I'm historian, although I teach as a member of the theology faculty, my official area is theology, there is a sense in which there is a narrative of modernity, particularly agreed to in the modern West. And that narrative of modernity is that the modern age is born as a result of the scientific revolution in the 17th century. And that scientific revolution is understood to be a rejection of the scientific and philosophical commitments of ancient Greece, of Aristotle, of the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas, and so forth, such that to be modern and to be scientific involves a rejection of the understanding of science, of philosophy, and so forth, so important in antiquity and the Middle Ages. And that and one of the crucial figures in this chapter of the origin of modernity is Galileo, who was thought to reject not only the science of Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, but also the role of religion, the role of the Bible in understanding the world, in dealing with scientific questions. So that in the figure of Galileo and others in the 17th century, we have modernity seeing a restriction of religious questions simply to an area of personal belief, of biblical interpretation, and not as giving us a fundamental understanding of nature that should be found in the natural sciences. And then furthermore, a rejection of the thought of Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle, whose thought is reduced to a kind of archaeological enterprise to look at the fossils of extinct species, as it were. So to be modern is to think that the traditional understanding of creation and science is irrelevant, because how do we know that? Because modern science is true and ancient science is false and so forth. So there is that general sense that to be modern is to pay little attention or only a kind of historical attention to the thought of people like Thomas Aquinas, Aristotle, and others. And furthermore, to think that any attempt to find a complementarity between developments in science and traditional theology and philosophy is a mistake, that there's a kind of hostility, is a kind of warfare between science and religion. And in that warfare, modern science has won and religion has lost. And religion has really nothing to tell us of importance about what it means for the world to exist, what it means to be human beings, and so forth. So there is this theme of a history of warfare between science and religion. And in that narrative, in that prevailing narrative, it becomes crucial thus to see that developments in cosmology show us that we don't need a creator to explain the origin of the universe. Science is sufficient. We don't need to appeal to God to explain biological changes. And in fact, evolutionary biology is sufficient to account for the origin and development of living things. We don't need to appeal to a creator. And in fact, to appeal to a creator violates a fundamental principle of modern thinking, a kind of that the universe and the processes within it are self-sufficient. We don't need any explanation of something outside or beyond to explain what's happening in the world. And that's a kind of thematic feature of what we might call a sort of totalizing naturalism, that we don't need to appeal to anything outside of, the natural order to explain the way things are. And so current debate about creation and science often occurs within this overarching thematic, or what I call the sort of a master narrative modernity.
Okay, so it strikes me that some of the work of advancing the arguments or narrating the history as you have described it or delimited it, some of the work is going to be a kind of conceptual therapy. So helping people to acknowledge certain conceptual idols, which they may have installed in the niches of their minds, but then also performing a kind of conceptual therapy on the actual practice of science or the practice of philosophy and theology or the practice of history, whereby one, heals and in healing, kind of begins to work again within the methodological bounds of the discipline properly so-called. Maybe some of that language is a little too metaphorical. Nevertheless.
But no, I think that's good. I like the theme of conceptual therapy. That's
So then, for those of us, who don't really have any competence in history or don't really have any competence in science, what do you think are, principles or arguments that we need to have in place when approaching this issue to do so responsibly? Because I think sometimes, like for us, everything will register as a kind of faith claim. It's like theologians say this, philosophers say that, scientists say that. I'm not prosecuting any of these disciplines, so they all strike me in a kind of similar way, like experts say. So how might we approach those things more responsibly or more methodically?
Well, it'd be good here to take some concrete or specific example and then work out from it to some more general principles. Let's take a relatively easy question, and that is the relationship between cosmological theories such as the Big Bang or multiverse hypotheses or an eternal or infinite series of Big Bangs and the doctrine of creation. I say that's relatively easy. It's easier to deal with this topic than the topic of evolution and creation, although we can talk about that as well. So the topic of cosmology and creation, there are sort of two ways in which this has unfolded in the 20th and early 21st centuries. Some people have thought that the development in Big Bang cosmology, a crucial development of the 20th century, which affirms in a kind of initial singularity to the universe from which our universe has developed, that somehow Big Bang cosmology offers a kind of confirmation of the traditional doctrine of creation. Now, others have said, Big Bang cosmology has been, in many places, transformed into a notion of, what happened before the Big Bang and before that and before that. So there are those who say that contemporary cosmological theories such as the multiverse or what happens before the Big Bang, show us that in some sense the universe is eternal and therefore doesn't need a creator. And my point would be that both positions, both those who use cosmology in terms of the Big Bang to deny creation, who use Big Bang cosmology to affirm creation, and those who use contemporary cosmological theories of the multiverse, an infinite series of Big Bangs, to deny creation, both sides misunderstand what creation is. So creation in the traditional sense, as affirmed by someone like Thomas Aquinas, has nothing essentially to do with whether or not the universe has a beginning. And what I mean by this is that creation is not a change. In the traditional sense, God doesn't change nothing into something. Creation in the traditional sense refers to a kind of dependence in existence, a dependence in being. And as Thomas often says, creatio non est mutatio, creation is not a change. Thus, to try to identify creation with some kind of primal change is, for someone like Thomas Aquinas, a category mistake, to misunderstand what creation in its fundamental sense is, a dependence in being. Similarly, those who say that the universe is eternal, that there is no primary change from nothing into something, those people also misunderstand that creation is this dependence in being, this dependence in existence. So that, as Thomas Aquinas would say, even if the universe were eternal, it still would have an origin. It still would be created. So that when one begins to understand creation in its fundamental sense as a dependence in being, that's a topic in metaphysics and theology. It's not a topic for the natural sciences. So it would be a mistake to use the natural sciences either to confirm that the universe is created or to deny that the universe is created. And this is one of the great insights of Thomas Aquinas, who addresses this question in the Middle Ages, I mean, not having all the arguments of contemporary cosmology, but still, in addressing the question in the Middle Ages, he's saying that that the natural sciences cannot tell us for certain whether the universe has a beginning or not, but nevertheless, we can know through metaphysics, through an understanding of what it means for things to exist, that the universe has a cause, that the universe is created. So the mistake that's being committed in contemporary cosmological reflections, either to affirm creation or to deny it, the mistake is to consider creation a kind of change. And it's sort of an easy, it's a mistake which is easily made, because when you say, you know, creation is out of nothing, that seems to suggest that there's a change from nothing to something. But as Thomas Aquinas helps us to see, as I've been reiterating, creation is not a change at all. And once one begins to understand that creation is not a change, one can see that the debate in contemporary cosmology, either to support creation or to deny creation, is a fundamental error. Now, one feature of this analysis is the crucial distinction that Thomas makes. He makes a distinction between a philosophical understanding of creation in the discipline of metaphysics and a theological understanding of creation, a theological understanding based on revelation and in faith, a theological understanding which includes the notion that the universe has a beginning. Thomas believes that the universe has a beginning. But he distinguishes that theological understanding of creation from a prior philosophical understanding of creation. So there are two features to the traditional understanding of creation set forth by Thomas Aquinas. Feature number one, creation is not a change. Number two, that there is a distinction between a philosophical approach to the question of the origin of existing things and a theological approach to the origin of existing things. And from a philosophical point, and the theological approach incorporates the philosophical and adds to it many things, including the view that the universe has a beginning. But the philosophical approach prescinds from the question of what of the temporality of the universe. The universe's temporality is whether the universe has a finite past or whether the universe is eternal is irrelevant to whether or not the universe is created in this fundamental philosophical sense. So here would be an example of conceptual therapy, right? By recognizing that there is, first of all, a distinction between a philosophical approach and a theological approach, even though for Thomas both are crucial. But still, from a philosophical approach, we don't have anything to say about the universe's temporality or eternity. An eternal universe would be just as much a created universe as a universe with a temporal beginning. Whether the universe is eternal or temporally finite concerns the kind of universe God creates, not whether or not the universe is created. And then these distinctions, which are central to Thomas's approach to creation, are either ignored, not known, or misunderstood in the contemporary debate over whether or not contemporary cosmological theories of any kind tell us anything about creation. And there's a range of contemporary cosmological theories, as I've suggested briefly, both from a kind of Big Bang cosmology in its sense of an original singularity, or variations in Big Bang cosmology, or notions of a multiverse, and so forth. So the current debate, and it is a current debate, I mean, William Lane Craig is a good example of someone who thinks that Big Bang cosmology shows us there's a creator. He has a kind of simple syllogism. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause, therefore the universe is created. Now it's true, whatever begins to exist has a cause. But the second premise, the universe began to exist, is highly debatable. How do we know that? How do we know that? In fact, even on this question, Thomas Aquinas was quite insightful. He remarks that we cannot know scientifically, we cannot know philosophically whether the universe has a temporal beginning. So that argument of William Lane Craig, from the point of view of Thomas Aquinas, doesn't work. But similarly, the argument of those who say, well, the universe never began to exist, therefore the universe does not have a cause. Those people who make that argument are making a mistake from Thomas's point of view in thinking that that to be created means to have a temporal beginning. Now that's pretty long, but maybe we can refine some of it if you like.
No, that's super helpful, and I think that the reference that you make to William Lane Craig and the Kalam cosmological argument is just a great instance in which Yeah, just because something lies ready at hand argumentatively, just because it's easily explicable or more easily explicable than more involved arguments, doesn't mean that we should necessarily reach for it. And you pointed out the problem with the second premise that the universe began to exist is not empirically verifiable or, you know, like dialectically, provable. And St. Thomas's argumentation to the point is super helpful or super fruitful. So then I suspect that for many of people approaching St. Thomas's writings on the doctrine of creation, this notion that it picks out a relationship of dependence, a kind of mixed relationship of dependence, that will appeal or that will register. But this idea of, you know, his doctrine of creation being somewhat neutral, as it were, or applying with equal rigor, whether we're talking about, a temporal creation or a kind of sempiternal creation, I think that will bend a lot of minds, and that might cause some disquietude. And certainly even contemporaries of St. Thomas, like St. Bonaventure, thought differently on the matter.
Oh, yes.
So maybe we could just take this as an occasion for refining yet further, what exactly we're picking out. You've talked about this, you know, this relationship of creation, but how is it that St. Thomas can conceive of a created universe which extends in potentially infinite fashion back into the past?
Okay. You're correct in saying not only Bonaventure, but also Albert the Great, Thomas's teacher, both would affirm that creation necessarily means a temporal beginning. Bonaventure says, when you say creation is ex nihilo, out of nothing, that has to mean a prior nothing and then a something. And Albert the Great says it has to mean that out of nothing has to mean before, has to involve the kind of priority. Otherwise, Bonaventure says, if out of nothing doesn't mean after nothing, it has to mean that the universe, that nothing is a principle of something. In other words, if you say the table is made out of wood, you mean the wood is a principle of the table. So if creation is out of nothing, and if you don't think it means after nothing, then you have to think that nothing is a principle of something, which Bonaventure says is absurd. So the only way to read out of nothing, for Bonaventure and for Albert, the only way to read out of nothing is to understand it to mean after nothing. Now, Thomas disagrees. Thomas thinks that the primary sense of out of nothing means this notion of the dependence in existence of things. In other words, what Thomas would say is if you begin to reflect on what it means for things to exist, and talking about the cause of their existence, and the cause of their existence requires some kind of prior causality which produces the effect of existence as such. So Thomas's reflection here is metaphysical. That is, by thinking about what it means for things to exist and by recognizing that existing things are not self-caused and yet they exist, and furthermore, the people who made the things are not the continuing cause of the existence of things, requires us to have a philosophical argument in the discipline of metaphysics about what it means for things to exist, which leads Thomas ultimately to the conclusion that there must be an uncaused cause of the existence of all things that exist. Now, notice this has nothing to do with the question of temporality. It has to do with the notion of what it means for things to exist and why existing things need a cause. Now, this argument is a complex argument in metaphysics, recognizing that existence is, as Thomas says in Latin, an actus essendi, an actuality which requires a cause, making it to be actually so. Throughout, this metaphysical argument has nothing to do with change. It has to do with the ongoing, complete causing of the existence of whatever is. So for Thomas, creation is not fundamentally some distant event. Creation is the ongoing causing of the existence of whatever is. That existing things need a cause, and that ultimately that cause, the causality must be an uncaused cause, is the fundamental feature of Thomas's argument in metaphysics for creation. Now, Thomas would say that for both Albert and Bonaventure, their mistake is in saying that creation has to be after nothing, is that they do not appreciate adequately that creation is not a change. That they tend to think that creation is a change, and therefore they apply principles of change to their understanding. Now, it's a supernatural kind of change for Albert and Bonaventure, but it still is a kind of change. And Thomas would say, no, creation isn't a change at all. So notice, this would involve some serious analysis of what change is and what is involved in any change. And Thomas thinks that metaphysical dependence, that is, the cause of existence of things, is not a change, but rather a dependency which is required in order for anything to exist, to continue to exist. So, creation in this philosophical sense, which is then incorporated into Thomas's theology, creation in this philosophical sense is the ongoing, complete causing of the existence of whatever is, that there must be such an ongoing, complete causing of whatever exists, is a requirement to understand why things exist at all, why there is something rather than nothing.
Okay, so then maybe that helps us in our kind of, again, I'm thinking of an individual who may not have a background in philosophy or theology, a background in history, a background in the modern empirical sciences. So I think that there can be a kind of intimidation factor when you hear that there is a conflict between faith and reason or between science and religion, that you'll never have a kind of sufficient technical competence or, you know, kind of wisdom-based savvy to navigate these issues with any real insight. And so you're going to be reduced to a kind of fideistic affirmation, or you're going to be reduced to, yes, some kind of hollow representation of the type of explanation that you just set forward. So I'd say, like, for those who are looking to refine their own understanding of these themes or looking to refine their own defense of not like one position or the other, but of the truth, you know, kind of insight into the truth and then exposition of the truth, what are some resources, or like what are some ways in which they can develop that muscle, or ways in which they can enter into that conversation?
Okay, well, I would say, first of all, that one might not fully understand the position of Thomas Aquinas on this question, and it is a complex philosophical issue. Nevertheless, there's a difference between fully understanding and some realization of what he says. So that even if one disagrees with Thomas's analysis, still his understanding of what creation is, which is the traditional understanding, whether it be true or whether it be false, it does not conflict with what the natural sciences tell us. So we can see that this conception of creation, even if we do not fully grasp it, especially the notion that creation is not change. Even if we do not fully grasp how he sets this forth, we ought to be able to recognize that there is no conflict between creation so understood and what the modern natural sciences tell us about the world. Now, there are any number of more popular ways to deal with this question. I'll even show you. I have a little booklet on, is it shown backward, on creation and science as science eliminated God. I mean, there's something. There are a number of resources to help in popular resources to help in dealing with the subject. Where else could we go? Well, we could go to the Aquinas 101 series of that the Dominicans have to help understand better Thomas's position. But as Aristotle said, To be educated on all these different subjects doesn't require that you be a specialist in all the subjects, but rather that you be able to examine the arguments of specialists to see whether they fit together, whether there is any inconsistencies, to look at their coherence. So we could look at contemporary claims by scientists, like Stephen Hawking or others, who draw philosophical and theological conclusions from their scientific theories. And we can distinguish between the scientific theories they set forth and the particular philosophical conclusions they reach. And at the very least, we can see, well, there really is a difference between the scientific arguments and the philosophical and theological conclusions drawn from them. And we can separate one set of arguments in science from the philosophical and theological conclusions. In fact, it certainly is the case that many people would find extremely difficult and recondite the particular scientific arguments about a multiverse, about an infinite series of big bangs and so forth, and similar to one might find difficult the metaphysical arguments of someone like Thomas Aquinas. But there are a number of more popular treatments of the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas which one can appeal to explain his philosophical and theological arguments. I mean, Stephen Brock, for example, at the University of Chicago, has an excellent introductory book to the title of which now escapes me, but to the thought of Thomas Aquinas. And there are similar books which provide a kind of general outline to the philosophical and theological questions. Now, Thomas is first of all a theologian, but he's also a philosopher. And indeed, he would think that he couldn't be a theologian without being a philosopher. So one can read, but still one can distinguish some of his philosophical arguments from his theological arguments. I'm not so sure whether I fully answered your question about what resources, but there are different levels of entry into this subject.
No, that's super helpful. And I think like a lot of folks are, they might be looking for an introductory text to read, or they might be just looking for resources that they could consume more passively on the internet just to get them a feel for the ongoing conversation without having to enter into all of its specificity.
Yeah. For my Chinese students, I've had them read essays by Stephen Brock, but also by people like William Wallace, Benedict sure. Ashley, and James Weissipel. Those are three very famous Dominican authors of the last century who have been particularly influential in my own work. And all of them are engaged, each one of them in different ways is engaged in looking at the relationship between among philosophy, theology, and the natural sciences. And they are very useful texts provided by those authors, both deep ways and more popular ways to look at these questions.
That's tremendous. Well, thanks so much for taking the time. I appreciate it. And thanks for clarifying these concepts for those who listen into the podcast.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. Okay.
Wonderful. All right, turning then to you, the listener, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Off-Campus Conversations on the Thomistic Institute podcast. If you haven't yet, subscribe, whether on your podcast app or on YouTube, so as to get updates when other things come out. So in the meantime, know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast.